This is The Guardian.
Earlier this week, we recorded a really powerful interview with Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, who was Health Secretary from 2009 to 2010. His work trying to secure justice for the victims of the Hillsborough disaster led him on to the infected blood scandal and work with campaigners that goes back over a decade. We didn't want news of the election being called to overshadow the stories of the victims of this scandal, so here is our conversation. Hello, Andy.
Hi, John.
Thanks for joining us. Before we talk about the details of the scandal and the inquiry, I wonder how you're feeling after everything you've heard this week.
Overwhelmed. More in just seeing the reaction of the people who were there, John. I mean, these are people who have been in the wilderness for 3, 4, 5 decades. To see them, just to see the different look in their eyes, in their faces, the weight lifted, was quite something, actually, to be there on Monday. So it was truly quite an overwhelming experience to be in the room as Sir Brian conveyed his findings, to see the reaction in the room. In life, moments like that don't really come around very often.
I'll come on to this in a minute. I don't think I've ever read about experiences as awful and heartbreaking as some of these. But also there's a real sense of anger, which you must feel as well.
Yeah, it does make me angry how the British state can do this, you know, and it's not just obviously the infected blood community. We can think of the sub postmasters and mistresses. We can think of the Hillsborough families, the Windrush generation and their families. And there is so many more I could mention or grieve one scandal after another. And yet the British state has had a habit of completely pushing people aside. A phrase was used on Monday that has been sort of haunting me ever since. One of the campaigners used a phrase about the brutality of the British state. And yeah, it conveys it, doesn't it? Because it can be brutal in the way that it deals with ordinary people.
We will talk about that and why that has been the case for so long later on. The final report into the infected blood scandal on Monday found the infection of 30,000 people with HIV and hepatitis between 1970 and 1991 was a preventable tragedy, which happened clearly in the midst of official arrogance, cruelty, and the constant evasion of accountability. All things that, as you've said, when it comes to the worst aspects of the British state, all of us are probably familiar with. Let's listen to a bit of audio from Brian Langstaff, the chair of the inquiry.
People put their faith in doctors and in the government to keep them safe, and their trust was betrayed. There are generally two elements to any major public inquiry. One, backward-looking, what happened and why. The other, forward-looking, what next? How do we stop it happening again? This inquiry is different. There is another third element to this inquiry's terms of references. What was the response of government and others in authority to what had happened? Here, the NHS and successive governments compounded the agony by refusing to accept that wrong had been done. More than that, the government repeatedly maintained that people received the best available treatment and that testing of blood donations began as soon as the technology was available, and both claims were untrue.
Around 3,000 people have died from receiving contaminated blood so far. Let's just quickly look at what the report concluded. Doctors, bodies including the NHS and successive governments, had repeatedly failed victims. There were a catalogue of failures which amounted to a calamity, that's the inquiry's word. Patients were exposed to unacceptable risks and far too little was done to stop the importing of blood from abroad that was high risk, clearly high risk. The scandal was not an accident and various bodies hid the truth, up to and including destroying documents. Andy, you were the Secretary of State for Health in 2009, a job you did for just under a year. And at that point, on the basis of guidance from civil servants, you responded to a letter from someone who'd been infected, saying there was no evidence that people were knowingly given contaminated blood. Now, later you discovered that wasn't true. Just explain to us the sort of chain of events between your first response and then finding out that the way that you responded wasn't right.
Yes, so I came into the Department of Health in the middle of 2009, and there was outrage in the infected blood community because the government of the day had just responded to what was called the Archer Inquiry, and it hadn't really responded, to be honest. It had left people, again, completely let down. And I didn't understand the anger, John. I'll be honest with you about that. I kind of was confronted by it. And I had to send letters to campaigners, some of whom came to my constituency office. And one of the replies sent had that line in it: nobody was knowingly given unsafe blood products. It was a few years later that I discovered that was untrue. And the reason I got to understand it was untrue was my good friend Paul Goggins, who was Member of Parliament for Wythenshawe and Sale East, who had been a prominent campaigner, a very close friend of mine, really my mentor in Parliament. He said to me when I was Health Secretary, conscious of the work I'd done on Hillsborough as Culture Secretary, and I'd come from all of that work into the Department of Health, he said to me, Andy, look, he said, there are echoes of Hillsborough in contaminated blood. You need to look into it in exactly the same way. You need to meet my constituents and just hear it from their perspective. So in January 2010, Paul facilitated a meeting in my constituency office in Lee. The Department of Health tried their best to prevent me from meeting them, but I did.
Whoa, now stop there. So tell me how they tried to stop you and why, as you understood it, they were trying to stop that meeting happening.
They just said there's nothing to be gained from meeting campaigners. You know, the issue's been dealt with. There's no liability. Yeah, it was, you know, very, very deliberate. And you know, obviously I ignored them. And it was kind of important, John, that I was meeting them in my constituency office and not in the Department of Health.
Because you were away from the machine and everything.
I was away from the machine. And it was January 2010. And if you remember, there was massive snowfall in that month in the north. It was, you know, there was like snow piled up on the side of the road. And it was a Monday morning that we'd arranged to meet before I went down to Westminster. And I got a message that the West Coast Main Line had been suspended. And I've got a really vivid memory of it going into my constituency office. But the campaigners had come in, and we in the end had 3 hours or more where we just chatted and talked. And two of them, Fred Bates, Eleanor Bates, Paul's constituents, they said to me, Eleanor said, I found out about Fred's hepatitis B diagnosis from a lawyer in, I think she said, you know, the 90s, even though Fred had been infected in the 70s. And I remember looking at her going, what, say that again, Eleanor. What? You found out, you weren't told, you know, even though it was in his medical records. She said, yes, the lawyer had finally got hold of Fred's medical records via the civil action that we were taking at the time and read out Fred's medical records and read out that he was Hep B positive. And she just said, you know, I broke down. I couldn't believe what was being told. And to me, at that moment in time, something kind of clicked a bit, I guess. And I understood that there was a cover-up in the same way that the amended police statements had told me about Hillsborough being a cover-up and that being the key to the Hillsborough lock. I began to think, well, hang on a minute, this can't be right. There's something very wrong here if medical records are not being shared and a diagnosis not being communicated. You know, when I was kind of beginning to get seriously, you know, inquisitive, and I went back to the Department of Health and I said to them, you know, I've just overseen the creation of the Hillsborough Independent Panel, and I think we need the same here, a disclosure panel to unpack some of the documents here. And the department went into completely, you know, defensive mode, full-on institutional resistance. No need for that. We've disclosed everything. You know, everything is out there. And that was basically where things were in early 2010. That was basically my introduction to the issue.
It's one of the most sort of viscerally awful elements of this story, this constant theme about doctors, the health service officials, bureaucrats, whoever they are, knowing that people had these conditions, these life-limiting, life-threatening, sometimes fatal conditions, and the people themselves never being told and their families never being told. I was reading yesterday about a case where it's one of the consequences, I think, of having that kind of hepatitis that you get cirrhosis of the liver. And a family coming to the conclusion that I think their father was an alcoholic, just because they were completely kept in the dark, and that seemed the only explanation.
That was a case that I used in my final speech in Parliament. I think you're referring to the same case. It relates to somebody called Ken Bullock, and I hope Ken's wife Hazel, who I met in person for the first time on Monday, actually, having spoken to her on the phone many times, but she wrote to me when she realised I was doing a lot more work on this whole issue. And she said how, when she finally saw Ken's medical notes, and this was years after, and I think after he died, actually, she saw repeated references to alcoholism, to liking a drink. And she said, and Ken never did really have too much to drink. You know, he was a very moderate, very light drinker, actually. And again, another moment where I thought, well, hang on a minute. These are the same tactics as Hillsborough, where you kind of immediately... You're putting the blame on the individual. But the notes were basically saying that the kind of need for, you know, a liver transfusion was down to Ken's behaviour. And Hazel, in a really articulate letter, explained why this was utterly offensive and wrong.
I just want to ask you a question that goes back to when you were Secretary of State for Health, and this came across your desk, and you gave the reply that you did on the advice of your officials. Just give us a sense of what it's like being the health secretary in charge of this vast institution. I mean, let's not forget, and this is part of what I think we should talk about, the NHS is reckoned to be the sixth biggest employer in the world after the Indian Ministry of Defence, the US Department of Defence, the People's Liberation Army of China, Walmart and Amazon. It is a huge hierarchical institution with the Secretary of State sitting at the top, in theory, in a position of oversight and control. But in any given day, what, hundreds of things came across your desk, is that correct?
Yeah, just absolutely huge number. You know, I take one, sometimes two red boxes home at night, and you'd be signing these letters at 11 o'clock at night, 12 o'clock at night. And I always try to read every single one in detail because, you know, you're always conscious that you've got that responsibility to people. But it's hard. God, it's hard, John.
But did it also feel absurd to be theoretically at the helm of this vast institution?
Well, obviously, you weren't answering for every bit of operation. You know, there was you were answering to issues that had come right to the top of the tree, and they're often very, you know, very significant things that you were writing to people about, to a point, I guess. But this was my third cabinet position, and I'll be honest with you, I was let me just get this right. I was 40 years of age at the time I was health secretary. This was my third cabinet position, so I wasn't a complete newcomer. I'd been 5 years by that point a government minister, but I'm going to be honest and say I did not think at that point in time that a false statement could be given to a Secretary of State. I didn't actually think that would be something that could happen.
In retrospect, then that's a watershed, but that's a watershed realization, isn't it? In terms of your instinctive understanding of government and how it works, that's a massively significant thing.
I trusted what was said to me by, you know, senior experts, and I had no understanding that might be needed to be, you know, pulled apart. It wasn't like it was a sort of a, you know, a nuanced statement. It was an unequivocal statement. But I at that point in time, I didn't think that it would be possible that people could put false statements to a cabinet minister like that.
Now, you've mentioned the Department of Health and the fact that they even tried to get in the way of you meeting Fred and Eleanor Bates from Withenshaw. I mean, that was the sort of level of micromanagement and sort of paranoia, really, looking back on their part, right, on that department's part. I wonder just about your general sense of what you heard from particular government departments and the sort of culture and feeling within Whitehall about the infected blood scandal. As you pursued it more and more, you'll probably know this. Earlier this week, Paul Johnson, the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, said that when he was working as a civil servant in the Treasury in the mid-2000s, this is a quote, ministers were perfectly well aware of this and quite deliberately decided not to do things to help. Did it feel like that to you?
Well, I certainly pointed the finger at the Treasury on Monday when Sir Brian outlined his findings, because I think if you want to understand the sort of... the ironclad nature of this cover-up, I think you have to go back to the start and this insistence from the Treasury that no liability could be admitted. And what I recall through my time in government is, and not just on this issue, on others as well, you know, there could be, you know, government ministers had to have their statements looked at so that there could be no implication of liability in anything that was said. Because, you know,
we should just underline that. This is really significant, isn't it? Because the point there is that this hugely significant, arguably the most single significant department of government, is arriving at that judgment not based on the details, the whys and wherefores, the level of human suffering in that particular case. This is just all about money. And at the point at which liability and therefore compensation rear their head, the Treasury collectively, its automatic instinct is to close it down.
Well, this, I think, is the brutality of the British state explained, because I think the way our system of government works, with the Treasury at the top of the tree in Whitehall, everything is seen through a financial lens. That's the thing, the perspective that governs everything. And it's this kind of paranoia about financial exposure prevents people doing the right things.
And is that why successive governments didn't want to fail to have an inquiry? Do you think that's the fundamental reason?
Well, what was just baked into the line was no admission of liability. But then ministers later down the line were just getting these really firm statements that have been repeated for decades. So, you know, how do you sort of unpick that when you're, you know, you've just arrived? Then a couple of things happened. As ever in politics, it's the random things that start to make the difference. In 2016, April, we got the second Hillsborough inquest verdict. And that was, an absolutely massive moment when that came through. And I responded in the House of Commons alongside Theresa May. And, you know, then shortly after, David Cameron, who was Prime Minister, left suddenly because of the referendum, and all of a sudden Theresa May was then Prime Minister. And I had said to her at the time that Infected Blood was another one after the Hillsborough inquest. It was at that moment in time that Diana Johnson came to me and said, "Can you speak to the all-party Blood Group, Andy, about whether what you did with Hillsborough can actually now in some way reignite our campaign?" It was a really...
And just to be clear, Diana Johnson is the Labour MP who's made a huge amount of the running.
Oh, she's made a massive difference, and I'll come on to explain how. It was at that point that I went, right, I've got a parallel here. Amended police statements opened Hillsborough. Amended medical records is going to be my key to this, or Diana's key. I worked with her on my final speech in Parliament. That was like, you know, I knew I could not leave Parliament without fully unburdening myself of all of this stuff. I threatened to go to the police with my evidence if the government didn't order a public inquiry by the summer recess. And here's the randomness of Westminster politics, John. I was leaving to become Mayor of Greater Manchester, or to try to become. Theresa May was newly in position as Prime Minister, and then unexpectedly called a general election. So I had that kind of thing that I'd said in Parliament hanging over a bit after I'd left. Theresa had a difficult situation where she didn't fully have a majority in the House. And Diana, this is the absolute superb piece of political work, went round the opposition parties and got them to commit to the public inquiry, including the DUP. And that was in the end what got this public inquiry.
Oh, what a sort of strange and random sense of the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, well, Westminster works like this. It's the random things that unlock things, you know.
But you have to wait a long time for everything to align. That's the problem, isn't it?
You do, that's how these cover-ups last for decades.
But you have said you'd like to see prosecutions. And just explain specifically what you're looking for here, because there are questions about corporate manslaughter, because that... or the relevant law only came into being in 2008. So tell me about how that might work conceivably.
Corporate manslaughter is something that I think does need to be considered. If you have a department that is set up to promote and protect people's health, but it wasn't honest about people's health, i.e. it oversaw a false statement about health, and that has impacted on people's ability to protect their own health, and potentially has had devastating consequences for people's lives, I think you do have to look at a, a corporate responsibility, corporate accountability. Now, I'm not saying that I know that there is a proven case here, but I think it should be looked at because I think it is systemic. You know, you could look at individuals within the system, and I think we should look at individuals who made false statements or anybody who destroyed documents and consider prosecutions in relation to them. But there is a corporate systemic responsibility here.
And who are we talking about there? Are we talking about the Department of Health and the NHS, or the NHS solely, or who?
I'm certainly talking about the Department of Health, but I think you could consider the Treasury in relation to that as well.
You would agree, presumably, that one of the most vivid feelings one gets from this week's news is that there is something lacking here, right? It's good that there's been that reckoning. It's good that compensation has been paid. It's good that the level of deceit has come out into the open. But at the same time, and this happens so often, that central question of what will or won't happen to the individuals and organisations at the centre of this remains unanswered.
It does. And this is another pattern that's now evolving as we're uncovering these injustices. You know, as we've kind of made the breakthrough with unlawful killing with Hillsborough, where was the individual accountability or the corporate accountability? That bit couldn't be achieved in that instance. And the risk is this is becoming the pattern as well, that you can say, hands up, yes, this has been uncovered. But it doesn't seem yet that we are prepared to go to that further step of individual and corporate accountability. But there has to be, because how else do you stop these things happening again until it is fully found that these departments hugely fail to fulfill their core purpose and put lives at risk as a result of doing so? How else do you get change in this country?
Okay, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be talking about the big issues which we've alluded to throughout this conversation that sit or are sort of woven through the infected blood scandal and what needs to change so anything like this does not happen again. Welcome back. It feels like this inquiry is just one of a long line of injustices, which Andy and I have talked about over the last 20 or 25 minutes. Bloody Sunday, Hillsborough, Orgreave, the post office scandal, the Grenfell Tower fire, even the birth trauma scandal that we keep hearing more and more about. It feels like there is a story here about our terribly centralised system of government, big institutions, and a very British evasion of accountability. Andy, you've said this a few times, that you, in your evidence of the infected blood inquiry, you drew parallels with Hillsborough. You've mentioned Windrush, I think. There are sort of things that have been coming to the surface more and more, which suggest to me many of the same things. There's a huge scandal, as you'll know, about the locking up of children and young people with learning disabilities and autism, which is gaining momentum every week. I'm doing some work at the moment about people's deaths under the care of NHS mental health services. What's going on here in the sense that we have a system of government which doesn't seem to be able to cope with and constantly pushes away and evades any meaningful scrutiny?
What's going on here is that the unelected British state has too much power.
And when you say the unelected state, go into that a bit. So what do you mean specifically? So in that sense, we know what the elected part is, right? That's politicians and that's ministers, right? But are you talking about another part of the state which has huge amounts of power, which somehow sits outside those systems of democracy and scrutiny that in theory we have via parliamentary democracy?
Yeah, the permanent state, the government departments, public bodies. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about, John. And I think, you know, the way that we have run things in this country, we've made it too easy for reputations to be put first, too easy to cover up when things go wrong. And that is why you have a list as long as the one that you've just read out, and you could add other things into that list. We have a scandal at least as significant in terms of its health impact, not just on those who were directly affected by the radiation, but on generations of family members and the health complications that came from that. And it's the nuclear test veterans. So these were service
barely talked about.
That's the cover up and the strength of it. These were service men, largely overseas in the post-war period in the 1950s and 60s as the sort of nuclear race was beginning around the world, and they were sent into nuclear clouds or made to face nuclear experimental nuclear explosions with zero protection, no consent. And to this day, they have had an inability to see their medical records. That's one that is, I would say, very similar in scale to infected blood that is not even barely really being opened yet. But then you have a different one, more recently, Orgreave, where Amber Rudd, as Home Secretary, ruled out an inquest because, in her words, quote, nobody died. But there was severe brutality, in my view, used that day, and the trial collapsed. You know, that was the complete politicization of a situation.
Yeah, and a public inquiry consistently refused down the years by anybody who could do it.
Post-Hillsborough, I started to campaign on this issue alongside Infected Blood, the whole issue of Orgreave. And the reason why, I always said the full story of Hillsborough can't be told until you know the story of Orgreave, because this is the same police
force. Same police force, yeah, yeah.
5 years earlier, in 1984, adopting exactly the same tactics against the miners that they would later deploy to more devastating effect against the Liverpool supporters. So you won't know how Hillsborough happened unless you understand the political cover that was given
right.
to this police force in the mid-90s.
So, yeah, in that sense, you have to open Orgreave to even now to shine sufficient light.
Yeah, and let me just quickly tell you about this. In the House of Commons, to me, in answer to me, when I asked about this to Amber Rudd as Home Secretary, she said they wouldn't be having an inquiry, even though one had got quite close under Theresa May as Home Secretary. She ruled it out on the basis that nobody died. That was the official reason she used to rule it out. Later, a book emerged called Diary of an MP's Wife by somebody called
Sasha Swires.
Correct.
Book. Yeah, yeah.
Which in one of the diary entries, she talked about having a late night dinner with Amber Rudd. She says Amber starts talking about what she'd recently done to rule out an inquiry on Orgreave because it would, words to this effect, tarnish Margaret's legacy. And the thing is this, it's only really a minister or a politician that can unlock these things. And, you know, sometimes politicians do not, you know, act in the public interest. They act in a party interest, as happened there. So these things, you know, keep repeating, John. And to be honest, I am always and forever will be grateful to the Derry families, the Bloody Sunday families, because when we were preparing for the Hillsborough Independent Panel report, I had the privilege of being in a meeting that we'd arranged between the Derry families and the Hillsborough families. And they gave us so much wisdom about people in the same position in justice across the UK coming together and working together. And that then, that made the difference, I think. One of the Blood campaigners, Jason Evans, told me on Monday that meeting in the Parliament when all the justice campaigns were together was a real sort of turning point for him.
It seems to me, running through most, if not all, of these stories, there is something about huge monopolistic institutions that we live with now, that the basis on which the British state works, that were created in a world where people were probably thought of as the masses and on the whole were much more deferential. And people aren't like that now. They're much more networked and organising. They're much more sceptical about authority. And as these scandals mount up, and actually in the course of their everyday experience as well, they have a sense that power and authority are very distant, remote, unaccountable things. And you see that recurrently in these scandals. I think you also see it politically. You know, that feeling of distance and unaccountability is part of the reason we got Brexit. It probably informed some of the momentum behind Scottish independence and so on. So there is a conversation to be had here. You've talked about the unelected British state, the failings of the British state, about how to change things.
Yeah, so I think what you have increasingly in modern times is an archaic, unaccountable British state coming into a sort of a direct collision with a highly networked, you know, formidable campaigning sort of infrastructure that now exists.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the 19th century trying to cope in the 21st century world. That's what it feels like.
It's a bit like that. But I think our political system is then caught in the crossfire. I've put the finger at the whip system, John, as being a part of this problem. And also,
draw the dots between the whip system and a scandal like this.
Because you kind of maybe have to have been in Parliament to really understand the full effects of it. You know, when you are in a kind of system of kind of parliamentary democracy, where in effect you're told to rubber stamp the official line, because that's what the whip system is often doing when you're the governing party. You are basically rubber stamping the Whitehall line. The whip system hands inordinate power to the unelected state, in my view, and is a part of the reason why these cover-ups last for so long. You know, Parliament has not done its job properly, and that's because Parliament is not set up properly to challenge the state in terms of all of its actions. So I think we need a complete rewiring of the British state.
As well as the things that you've mentioned, do you think that rewiring or restructuring also applies to the sheer size and the sort of hierarchical nature of these organisations and government departments that we're talking about? Because it's in the nature of very, very large, extremely hierarchical organisations that they evade accountability, right? That happens in the private sector with huge corporations. And I wonder, I believe this is true, I'm convinced of this, that some of the explanation for these scandals lies in the sheer size and the centralised nature of the NHS, the Department of Health. I mean, I could go on. You know, the same applies to the Department of Work and Pensions, the Department of Education, etc.
Well, if you were to break them all up, though, I don't know whether you get more accountability, because it can sometimes be harder to hold. You know,
but it would bring them. But it would bring them closer to the people they're meant to serve, would it not? And also, it is easier to scrutinise a small institution than an extremely large one.
Possibly. I think that's a bit of an open question.
I thought you were a devolution man. That's why I'm asking you the question.
But I'm going to give you, I think, a better solution. I'm not saying yours is wrong, but a better solution is that statutory duty of candour on all civil and public servants. That responsibility, requirement, in fact, to tell the truth at the first time of asking. That it's about culture change first, I think, rather than necessarily organisational or structural change. That might be necessary, but I think you've got to go to the heart of the job. And actually, a statutory duty of candor would empower those people, John. It would empower people to do the right thing and then prevent these cover-ups lasting so long. So it's culture change, I think, you need before structural change.
Last question. It seems to me that running through just about everything that we have talked about, unavoidably, is a strong sense about the most British theme of all, arguably, which is the class system. That a lot of this is about people seen as little and insignificant and expendable by people in much more powerful and privileged positions. And if you talk about that in the context of the British state, which, as we both know, traditionally and still to this day, is dominated by people from very, very rarefied backgrounds, unavoidably you're talking about class. That's true, isn't it?
I think it is. I think it is the thread that runs through all of this. It's too easy to cover up, as I said before, and it's almost like inbuilt to dismiss people, you know, banging on the door from the outside as insignificant. The most chilling moment, really, in many ways, of the whole thing this week, and there were many, many aspects of it that made you just shiver go down your spine. But it was when Sir Brian read out a memo from a civil servant talking about a minister, I think in the Blair government, who had been asking questions about blood. And do you remember, John, it said something like, the minister is getting too sympathetic towards the blood families. You know, they're not reading their briefing. We gave them briefing and lines and they're not taking the lines. And, you know, we'll have to do something about this. I mean, that really was a sort of moment where you just go, oh my goodness, you know, this is what, if you like, the ordinary people, the little people as they see them, are up against. This wall of indifference, of inhumanity, a lack of compassion at the heart of the British state. That is what is revealed by the infected blood inquiry. My goodness, they've done a wonderful job on behalf of us all. The question is, what are we now going to do with their findings?
And in a sentence, what's the answer to that question?
Rewire the British state.
Andy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please subscribe to Politics Weekly UK, wherever you get your podcasts. And for more about the very vivid, extremely moving human stories detailed in the report, our sister podcast, Today in Focus, spoke to people who had been deeply affected by the infected blood scandal in their episode, which went out last Friday. Search for Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.